Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Kristen, and we are going to be talking about the final book in N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy, The Stone Sky, which won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 2018. So hi there, Kristen.
Hi. So great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And you have joined one of the nomination panels that I've done before. You happen to join like the longest and most extensive one for the novellas this year. I'd never done that before and didn't realize I should probably pare down the guest list drastically. Because that went on a long time.
It went on for a while.
Yeah, it did. But you have your own cool BookTube channel. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I've been doing it for almost, I guess, going on 2 years, like a year and a half. And I talk about science fiction and fantasy, and I focus a lot on new releases. Kind of the conceit that I have with the channel is that I wanted to bring more discussion of the Hugo Awards and other science fiction awards to BookTube, because I was kind of looking for more. I'm like, well, I guess I need to be the content I want to see.
Yeah.
So I talk a lot about the Hugo Awards and stuff, and a lot of my reading is focused on consuming as much eligible work as possible so that I can kind of give some commentary on what I think the best books are. I can knowledgeably commentate on like, well, here's a short list. Here's what I like about it or don't like about it. Here's what I think is missing. So I just have a lot of fun with that. And I mean, other than that, I just focus on reading and reviewing and discussing things with others. So I found that BookTube is a really wonderful way to make friends with, you know, similar interests.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I've dipped my fingers a tiny little bit into the BookTube market by putting my nomination panels on YouTube. And it's something I'm thinking of doing more of at some point, maybe after I finish the main project. But we were talking before we started recording that even though you're focused on covering the Hugos and bringing some of that up, you haven't done a ton of reading in the older Hugo Awards.
Yeah, not a ton. I've done some. I was saying before we started that my history getting into science fiction and fantasy books is that I didn't really realize that I liked science fiction until a little more recently. It's something that I did enjoy, but I didn't recognize it. I think part of that's just being a woman and kind of there's that assumption that, you know, science fiction is more for boys or something.
Sure.
And so I grew up reading some science fiction, but not recognizing that it was science fiction and I was liking it. So I, a few years ago, I decided that I needed a hobby. And my husband was really into Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons. And he was making friends and connecting and finding community through that. And I was jealous, but I wasn't into those things. So I'm like, I need to pick something. So I picked science fiction fantasy books because I really enjoy that. And I've found my community now. And I started out with Goodreads groups. And so one of the first Goodreads groups I got involved in was a group focused on reading the Hugo winners and even the nominees. So I read a few through that group and realized a lot of these books are problematic or not fun to read. Mm-hmm. I read a few too many that just featured pointless sexual assault and violence against women. And I was really excited that there were so many women in the Hugo shortlist these days. And I just think that the Hugos and science fiction as a genre are going in a much better direction now. And I'm excited about that. So that's kind of where I want my focus to be.
Nice. Yeah. I was going to ask if science fiction and fantasy have been something that you've kind of enjoyed all along or if it's more recently become a passion. So that's interesting. I just assumed it was like, you know, you're an old school nerd from way back.
I kind of am. I've watched most of Star Trek. But it's kind of something where, you know, like I did that as a kid, but like, once again, I didn't recognize, like I even as a young adult read Ender's Game and all of these books and just loved them, but then didn't realize until a few years ago, that's all sci-fi and you really like it. Like maybe you should actually just look for it now and make that your thing.
That's cool. So kind of moving into the discussion of this book, and this question gets more ridiculous as I get down to the end of the list and there are only a few things to choose from, but you know, why this book? Why did you choose this one from the, I guess, several other possibilities?
Because I love and adore N.K. Jemisin. She's one of my favorites. And this trilogy is just outstanding.
Yeah, I agree. Just to rip the spoilers off about my thoughts about the series. I think the series and this book are just tremendous. I think normally we would have a somewhat extended non-spoiler discussion. I think it makes sense to talk about our overall thoughts and then just kind of go straight into spoilers. And I do want to let people know, you know, obviously to talk about this book, we have to spoil the situation where it was at the beginning of this book, which is spoilers for the previous two. So if you haven't checked out this series, I really highly encourage you to do so.
Yeah.
That being said, do you want to give a quick description of kind of the plot of this book, how it's structured, and then we can go into overall thoughts?
Yeah. So this book kind of is, I mean, it's the last book in the trilogy, so it has to tie up all the loose threads. And it ends up, you know, with this climax of, am I trying to do non-spoiler?
That's, I mean, it really is hard, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, we're on a planet that is having major geological problems, and there is a big event that is going to potentially change that in a major way. And we learn a lot about one of the other factions that we haven't learned as much about in the previous two books.
Yeah, I think that's as much as you can do. I think it's fair to say that we learn a lot more about the Stone Eaters.
Yeah,
and I love that. And we learn more about how the Fifth Seasons came to be.
Yeah,
from the deep history of this planet.
We also learn a bit more about the Guardians.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, we both kind of hinted that we really like these books, and I saw that in your October episode. I can't remember what you call them now.
Journal,
there we go. You had mentioned that you'd been rereading the series in anticipation of talking about this one, and something that you really enjoy.
Yeah.
I didn't go back and reread them. What I tend to do is go back and listen to my previous episodes just to kind of get a sense for where my head was at on the previous books. This one I had, when I finished The Obelisk Gate, you know, it's just like, okay, I need to know how this comes out. And so I listened to the audiobook for The Stone Sky. And when I did the same thing for the Fifth Season back in the day, when I eventually got back to reading The Obelisk Gate in print, I hadn't remembered anything from the audiobook. And I think it just goes in differently when I take something in on audio, especially if I'm not doing it for an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had gone... After that episode, I went and listened to The Stone Sky, and that one stuck a little better just because it's the end of the story. And so I remembered a lot of it, but a lot of the details I had forgotten. And so it was great going back and actually, I listened to the audiobook again and I read it again in print. I think every book that I read in this series made me admire the whole series more, just in terms of the structure of it, how well the characters are developed, how amazing the world building is. And I'm not the world building person. I have very little patience for descriptions of trees and topography, in epic fantasy and that kind of stuff. But it's done so skillfully here. I just love it.
Yeah. N.K. Jemisin is just a master of world building. And characters. I would say world building and characters are where she really shines for me.
And that's something that, you know, can be different when you compare early Hugo winners, for instance, with more recent ones. I feel like the characters are something that to me stands out as better.
Yeah. And you know, you say you're not a world building person. I'm really not a character person. I don't need really strong characters, but I do really enjoy Jemisin's characters.
Yeah. I guess it'd be worth, you've obviously read more, have you read more of N.K. Jemisin than just the Broken Earth trilogy?
Yes, I've read almost everything.
Okay. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? I mean, how does this fit into her overall bibliography?
Yeah, I mean, all of her series are really different worlds with different vibes, but I mean, what remains true across all of them is her just mastery of character and world building. But her first written book was actually the first book in the Dream Blood duology, but no one would publish it. So she wrote The 100,000 Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And that's more of a fantasy with gods and things, whereas the Dream Blood is kind of an Egyptian kind of inspired fantasy with like blood magic and stuff. And then the Broken Earth trilogy is a wildly different world from either of those. And I think what's cool is that there's not gods and magic the way there are in the other fantasy worlds. This is more
right.
more of a sciencey fantasy than her other fantasy books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was listening back to my episode on the Obelisk Gate, and my guest and I kind of had opposite takes on, for me, the fifth season felt more like science fiction, and then the Obelisk Gate, I was like, oh, it's magic, so I guess we're fantasy. And she kind of took it the opposite way. But like you said, it is sort of blending of the two, because it's scientific uses for magic, right? If magic is mm-hmm. a substance that can be mined and that can be controlled, that puts it into more of a sciencey kind of lens.
Yeah, it's really fun because she uses magic. She even uses the word magic, but she approaches it in such a scientific way.
Yeah,
it's like she's treating it like science, and we don't understand it, so we just call it magic. But the way she, like, it's like, this is the way this material works scientifically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, one of the humors from the old, the idea of the, you know, bile and blood and things in the history of medicine, right? Where magic mm-hmm. is just another substance that runs in between our cells.
Exactly. Yeah. But I would say also just comparing all of her works together, a major theme that I see running through all of them is really exploring this relationship between oppressor and oppressed and how systems work and can harm people and kind of this theme of resistance and fighting back.
Yeah. The interesting thing for me with the cycles of oppression and you know, systemic oppression and all that kind of stuff is the fact of the layers that she builds into it, because you kind of learn through this book that, okay, this is nothing new, that one group is essentially taking advantage of, you know, using other people for their advantage. It's a thing that's been happening for generations. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the deeper you go, the more layers you kind of find.
Yeah. And she makes the villains complicated too, which is nice. She doesn't just paint them as, you know, mustache twirling comic book villains, you know, like
yeah.
I liked how she portrayed Shaffa as this very complicated person with his own oppression in some ways, you know, both oppressor and oppressed can each be oppressor and oppressed on their own.
Yeah. And I do want to let people know from here on, let's just go full spoilers.
Sure.
Because it makes sense, right? Because when you have a character like Shaffa, who's definitely an antagonist in the first book, and then in the second book, he's changed, and it kind of helps you swallow some of his transformation. But by this book, he's very sweet with Nasun and very fatherly. And she even calls it out, right? She says, look, you're my new father. And I really admire, you know, his character finding out what she wants to do and saying, it's fine, make the end that you need and I'll support you. And that was very, very touching.
Yeah. Even the way that he changed at the end was confusing though in some ways, because he was so sweet with Nasun, but then he was still, you know, genociding other people at the same time.
But yeah, like you said, it's a complicated character. And so it's interesting and is skillful on the part of the author that it gets you to sympathize with this character who's done such horrible things.
Right.
Structurally, this book is, you know, the second and third books are different than the first one, right? They don't have the first book, the big spoiler is it's got three character viewpoints and it's the same character at different times in her life. Where in then the Obelisk Gate and this one, it's switching perspectives between Esun and Nasun. And this time you have the additional point of view. So you have the second person stuff still from Esun. You have then third person omniscient kind of thing from Nasun. And then you have first person from Hoa. And that takes us back to the origins of all of this. And not all the way back, but back to where the fifth seasons began. And that's really, really interesting. It's the way Jemison pronounces it is Syl Anagist, but the audiobook says Syl Anagist. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And that was really, really interesting. I like the fact, I didn't even notice until reading through it this time, that those chapters from Syl Anagist are counting down, and counting down to Geor Arcanity, they call it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed learning all that history of the Stone Ages. I think the Stone Ages are such an interesting concept, or I don't know, I thought they were so cool.
Yeah, yeah. And so I did want to talk a little bit about that, about the whole idea of the conductors and tuners. And at first I thought, are Hoa and Gewa and all the other tuners, are they androids or are they just more like bioengineered humans? And I think it's more that.
Yeah, that was my impression.
and they're kind of sculptured, you know, bioengineered to be able to use magic and to do orogenic kind of things as well.
Right.
But there's so much grim stuff there about the briar patch, you know, and what happens to them when they're more or less decommissioned. And you have the character Kalenli, who's evidently not, she's bioengineered, but not the same way that that Hoa and the others are. Mm-hmm. And she is the one who wants to pull the curtain back and say, hey, you know, this stuff isn't cool. This here's where it comes from. And that's where you learn about the Nies, who were a previous, you know, basically a victim of genocide way back in the day.
Right.
And I mean, we're in spoilers. And so I think it's fair to talk about the sink lines and the, you know, essentially you find out that Sylanagis is built literally on top of the Nies, who aren't even fully dead. They're still being essentially mined for their magic. And that's absolutely horrifying. But it's also very much, there's the idea of systematic oppression and one group advancing at the expense of another. That's really thematically deep.
Yeah. I think I might have missed when I read the built on top of the Nies thing. I don't remember that part.
Yeah, it at some point I can't remember when they go to Kalenli's house, essentially. Eventually they start investigating what the sink lines are, and they're there with Conductor Galat, who I do have a question about Conductor Galat that I'm wondering if you can help me answer. He just kind of says, yeah, okay, I guess at this point you can sense this, and reveals that here the Nies have essentially been, the only way I could picture it is they're buried in pits, and then there are essentially wires that are extracting their magic, and that's what they're charging all the obelisks with.
Oh, wow. I have to say, I find the Stone Sky more than the other two books to be, like, have tons of things like that, like, blink and you miss it. There's so much.
Yes. Yeah. This was where I feel like on this read through, reading it and then also listening to the audiobook. And when I do that, I tend to overlap. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if I'm doing a chore, I'll be listening to the audiobook and I get ahead of myself and then I catch up in reading it. And there's always things that I miss on one or the other. But that was an interesting thing to me. And it reminded me of, there's the famous James Baldwin, William F. Buckley debate where James Baldwin says, He's talking about the history of oppression. He says that the economy, especially of the southern states, could not possibly be what it has become if it had not had for so many years cheap labor. And that's what that reminds me of, is that here there's this civilization that is trying to do this thing where they're going to have unlimited, you know, energy and be able to do all this ridiculous stuff with magic. All they have to do is completely exploit a previous people that they've conquered, and also completely exploit the earth below them. And it's there's the oppression angle of it, then there's the exploitation of natural resources angle of it as well, because the idea is if we can tap the earth, you know, the magic at the core of the earth, well, then it'll never run out. And that's the way humans think, right? This is so vast as to be unlimited. But of course it never is unlimited.
Right. Yeah, it's very, very you know, like, it has nothing to do with the real world, right? Like, there's no relations. Like,
yeah,
I think just Jemison did an amazing job just creating this world that really portrays that in kind of a way that we can kind of stand back and look at and be like, oh, that's not us, until you think about it and you're like, no, that's completely us.
Yeah, and that's, you have the quote I wrote down in the book, someone must suffer if the rest are to enjoy luxury. But there's also the discussion in the book that says this was, you know, the systematic oppression of the origins, for instance, that was never the only choice,
right?
To do that, to oppress this people who are absolutely necessary to the survival of humanity. We did not have to harness them and control them. We could have partnered with them. There were always different choices to make. And when you look back at our history, there were always different choices, and we, you know, just tend to choose the wrong ones.
Yeah.
Talking about Conductor Galat, the thing that I had the question of, it is mentioned that he has those ice white eyes, and so I'm just assuming that he's Shaffa.
Oh, wow. Maybe you're right. I never made that connection.
We have the other part where Steele mentions that Shaffa is older than many of the Guardians.
Yeah.
But he does say that he wasn't from the first generation. He didn't think he was from the first generation. So it's there's some doubt there. Because I would think that he would have remembered Galot.
Yeah.
Although it does talk about how when someone becomes a Stone Eater, they lose some memory.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know. I feel like this is the kind of book where if you go back over it a few times, you might make more and more connections like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I'm curious to get your take on this. There's sort of the three phases of the book, and the Nasun and Esun parts are starting to converge, right? They're starting to move towards a convergence point in the climax of the book. But I was much more interested in the stuff in the deep past.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Well, I have to say, the first time I read it, I had a kind of an opposite experience to you. I think you were saying that you remembered the Stone Sky the best. I remembered the fifth season the best. Like, I was reading it again. I'm like, I remember everything that happens crystal clear. But the last two books, I think the first time I read them, I just wanted to know what was going to happen so bad that I kind of read them too fast. So this time I actually paid attention. Like, okay, I need to remember what the actual plot of this is because I did not remember the plot at the time. So I think the first time I read it, I was really wanting to see Esun and Nasun reunited and see what was going to happen once they found each other. But I think on the second read, I was way more interested in the older story, the story of the Stone Eaters. I was interested the first time too, but I think I also think that after reading through the whole thing the first time, what I remembered and loved the most was the Stone Eaters. There is something just so magical and whimsical about them.
And you learn more about them, and you even get the idea that, because at the end of the previous book, Esun has used the Obelisk Gate and in order to win the battle with Rhenanus. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, she has turned one of her arms to stone. And Hoa begins consuming it, and there's that interesting little bit where he says that this is not sustenance. And it made me just kind of go, what does that mean exactly? And I did have the theory, at the back of my brain going, oh, I think I know now why we've had the second person narration the whole time, because I think Hoa is explaining all of this to Nasun or to Esun after she becomes a Stone Eater. Turned out to be right.
Yeah.
It wasn't super, super obvious, but it made a certain amount of sense, especially when you kind of had the revelation at the end of the previous book of Alabaster as a Stone Eater.
Yeah.
It wasn't explicitly stated, but you do find out in this one.
Yeah. I felt like I knew that after reading the fifth season, but maybe I'm not remembering right.
Yeah. I think Hoa mentions that he's the narrator at the end of the first one.
Oh, but not that she's a Stone Eater. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I could be wrong as well about that one. It's been a long time since I read that book. Although I hear what you're saying about remembering the events of that one better. And I think I do remember what happened in that one in the kind of three phases of it. In the Sil-Anagis part, you get kind of the building, not dread, but like Hoa keeps saying something like, you know, we should have seen this. We should have caught this. We should have realized what was happening. And you get that bit that when you pour magic into something, you know, magic comes from life. And so you should know that if you're tapping magic, that thing that you're tapping it from is probably alive in some way. And then as you feed magic into something, it can become alive. And so the onyx can kind of have its own will. And also they should have known that the earth had its own will. And they didn't realize that until it was too late. And I remember all the way back from, I think the first time we met Tonki was in one of those sockets where the obelisks had been, and there's all the metal points coming out of them that in the obelisk gate, I think a fragment of that breaks off and tries to run up Tonki's arm, like to turn her into a guardian. And I had just assumed that those metal things were part of creating the obelisk, but you don't find out until this book that no, this was the earth investigating what the humans were doing with the obelisks. And so those are not designed to be part of the obelisk process. That was the earth figuring out what was going on and trying to subvert it.
Yeah. The earth is such a fun character.
I didn't remember until this book, and until listening back to my previous episode on the obelisk gate, that the earth says the same thing to Nasun that it says to Esun, you know, hello, little enemy.
Yeah.
And says the same thing to the tuners as well, to Hoa and the others.
Yeah.
One thing I thought was, I didn't remember that they had gone to the moon. That was something I completely had forgotten, because it leaves you with the question of, well, how did they get back from the moon? And the book just completely yada yadas it.
Yeah, I know.
Which I kind of admire.
Yeah, it's like you can read it and not even like really notice. Like, hey, wait a sec. Mm-hmm. They flung the moon away from the Earth while they were on it, and then they somehow got back.
Yeah. And Hoa says, if you ask me that, I can't give you an answer. I just remember falling and burning. So, I mean, it's a universe with magic, right?
Yeah.
So it's fine.
Yeah.
But I don't know, from a more science fiction fan standpoint, like, I want to know exactly what happened there. I mean, they had a vessel that took them there. So
yeah,
it's not completely out of the realm of possibility that the new, guardians who, you know, it's the same kind of instance where that core stone that they had on the moon explodes and infects all the conductors and turns them into guardians. And it's possible that then the Earth could command them to load everybody up onto that, whatever that ship was, and get them back to Earth. But I don't
know. That's a good explanation.
It works for me.
Good enough.
do you have a good sense of what Nasun's plan was?
I feel like Nasun wanted to literally blow everything up. Like, she wanted to end the world because she felt the world was too broken.
Yeah.
But she also wanted to save Shafa. Was she going to turn everybody into stone eaters?
I don't think that was her plan all along. And so I'll invite listeners to help out with this one, because it got a little muddled for me at some point, because I thought, oh, she's going to catch the moon. All right. She's going to redirect it and have it impact the Earth.
Yeah.
Right. That would be, that would sort of recapitulate kind of our theory about how we got our moon, was there was a big impact and it split off a big chunk that then cooled and formed as a satellite. But then when it gets down to that point, when she's at core point and she's ready to start using the obelisk gate, she says she can see the moon, which she's going to let just fly by. And so I guess she wasn't going to destroy it that way. Maybe she was going to do something like Alabaster did with the rifting. Maybe she was just going to do something even more extreme. And she was willing to die to do it.
Yeah, that was kind of my impression, that was that she was so fed up with the world that she wanted to basically kill everything. And she was going to use the obelisk gate to do that. But then I think somewhere along the line, she decided she wanted to save Shafa. And I think she was going to turn everybody into stone eaters so that she could do that.
Yeah, that was kind of the Earth's last-ditch effort to save itself, because it realized what her intention was. And so it extracted the core stone from Shafa so that he was now, and she realized when she came upon him, he was no longer suffering, because he had been, when they traveled through the Earth's core, mm-hmm. that had caused a lot of damage to him. And so he was basically comatose for a long time. And then once that core stone was extracted, he wasn't suffering anymore, but he was also dying.
Right.
And so the Earth was like, okay, you've got one option for saving him. Just turn him into a stone eater. And oh yeah, oh, by the way, if you turn him into stone eaters, everybody gets turned into stone eaters.
Right. It wasn't that also Steele's plan. He was trying to get her to do that.
To turn everyone to stone eaters?
I think so.
I got the impression that Steele just wanted an end, right? And so he ended up being satisfied with the end that they got with ending the seasons, but I think he wanted the Earth to die, because he knew that he couldn't die without the Earth dying. Because he has that speech where he's saying, look, I'm 40,000 years old. Can you imagine what that's like?
Yeah.
And so ultimately he was satisfied with the fact that there was an end to the seasons and an end to the hostilities between humanity and the Earth. But I think, yeah, he wanted a more violent end. He wanted what Nasun wanted.
Right.
It was fascinating when Nasun got to Core Point that she kind of observed the Stone Eaters there, and they don't behave like normal humans. Like, one of them is sculpting a tree, which we would do with using arbors or stakes or things like that. But instead, you know, it was just holding a branch in a particular place, and it would hold it for days or weeks or however long it needed to, and then move on to do the next thing. And then another one was feeding a whale, which was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was some really nice world building, just showing how different the Stone Eaters are, and it was a really whimsical way to do it.
The other thing at Core Point is there's the magic bed that Nasun ends up putting Shafa in when he's comatose, because and realizing that it's cleaning up his waste, it's cleaning him, it molds to him, and she just wonders, why would anyone ever need this? And just kind of that's the why would a society that had that kind of magical technology, why would they decide that they needed more? That's what it said to me. Like, why did you need to then tap the Earth's core? You know, you already had some amazing stuff. And we find out that the some of that amazing stuff is from the Nies, who are still suffering. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just sort of a, why do you need this technology?
Right. Just the plain greed.
Yeah. What did you think of Nessun finding Alabaster's journal?
I thought that was fun. I think I knew right away that it was Alabaster's journal, and it just, I think more than anything, it was just a nice way to kind of tie together some separate threads. Like, it felt good to have the Nessun thread meet the Alabaster thread, because Nessun has no idea about Alabaster, right? And this whole thing that's happening. So it's kind of nice for her to get a glimpse of what's been happening outside of her own story.
Yeah. I thought if there was anything clunky in the book, that was it. It was just a little out of left field. I don't really mind it, because it lets you kind of square Nessun being not really thinking about her mother much. To if she read Alabaster's journal, she would probably gain some empathy for the things that Nessun had been through.
Yeah,
and so that helps me understand how ultimately she executed Nessun's plan.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see Nessun kind of growing throughout the book and realizing, or having more empathy for her mother as she discovers, like, oh, this is what the fulcrum was like. This is what my mother went through. This is, you know, what her history has been. And so I think it's kind of preparing her and us for that final showdown where she does finally reunite with her mother.
Yeah, talking about the fulcrum reminds me of another one of the sort of layers of oppression that you get, because you had Nessun, who was abused essentially by the fulcrum, right? Mm-hmm. Shafa broke her hand. You know, there were all these awful things that were done to her that then she felt like she needed to do to Nessun. And it's this generation on generation, you know, you can get the oppressed person to oppress, you know, their descendants and keep that cycle going. It's just the thematic depth of these books is just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that was really wonderfully portrayed, because especially when you are a child and you're being told that this is right and good, we're breaking your hand because this is what we have to do, this is the best thing to do. You have to become incredibly critically conscious and be able to analyze that, you know, usually as an adult, but I mean, often adults don't ever get to that point where they do that and recognize that was trauma bonding, that was evil, that was abuse, because there's a part of our minds that protects ourselves. You know, it's painful to admit that wasn't love, I wasn't safe, you know? And so then if you don't confront that, you do discontinue it because you haven't decided it's wrong yet.
And that reminded me of, you know, all the way from stuff like corporal punishment, right? Spanking. I got spanked as a kid, so now I'm going to spank my kid because look how I turned out, right?
I'm fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no trauma with that. Or like, you know, people who are like, I don't want my kid vaccinated against chickenpox. It's no big deal. I got chickenpox when I was a kid and you know, it was fine. So good idea to get vaccinated. All the stuff with Hoa talking, Hoa and Steel, and talking about the length of the life of the Stone Eaters and how lonely it is, was fascinating to me. With the Hoa says to Nessun at some point, you know, at the beginning we were kind of lonely, and so we made other Stone Eaters, and we didn't do it quite properly, and so now they're the hungry ones. They're the ones that are stealing the stone bodies from Renanus, because at some point there's that interesting scene where they arrive in Renanus and realize, there's not as many bodies here as there should be.
Yeah.
And so they're somewhere in a Stone Eater larder pantry someplace being slowly consumed.
Yeah. And I appreciate that Jemison like kind of infused some humor in that also.
Yes.
Like the way the bodies were left and stuff.
Yes. I think of one in particular.
Yeah.
The desert crossing part in the Essun portions of the book is pretty tough And it's portrayed really, really well. Just there's the inevitability of it, mm-hmm. Where early on, I think I can't remember who someone's killed and then they're saved for later. And Essun says something like it was always going to come to cannibalism at some point during this crossing. And that's, whew,
yeah,
that's rough.
Yeah. I found those sections a little bit harder to get through. I remember the first time I read it, especially having that mindset of like, I just want to know what's going to happen. I remember finding some of those scenes that are just them on this really hard journey to be a little bit of a slog sometimes.
Yeah. I think, you know, the function of those scenes is to make it so that Essun doesn't immediately go to Khor Point. Mm-hmm. And because she feels like she has a responsibility to Kastrima because of what, you know, she essentially broke Kastrima under in doing what she did with the Obelisk Gate before. And so she feels like, I have a responsibility to get these people to the next place, mm-hmm. which is mixed with they feel an obligation to her to bring her along, even though she's kind of comatose after turning her arm into stone. But that, yeah, it forces the confrontation further down the road.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think the scenes were necessary. I mean, just to show the world too, like, you know, they keep saying the world is bad, the seasons are bad, but we needed to like actually see it, I think.
I don't think Jemison has children. When I've heard her in interviews, and by the way, there are some great videos of her being interviewed, or like her acceptance speech at the 2018 Hugo Awards is fantastic.
Yeah.
She's just very, very good. Mm-hmm. But the part at the end where there's the final confrontation between the showdown between Nasun and Essun, who have opposite ideas of what they want to do, and they have essentially equal and opposite force to bring to bear on things, because Nasun has all these obelisks, and then Essun has the onyx, and so different keys, I guess, to unlock the door. There's the point where Essun realizes that it's a standoff. We're basically both going to turn to stone here, and nothing's going to happen. And so she ultimately just yields. Mm-hmm. And that reminded me, you know, as a parent, there's a certain point where your kids are going out there into the world, and you have to be able to kind of let go and let them make their own choices.
Yeah, I think you're right. Jemison does not have kids, but the way that she is able to portray motherhood in this trilogy is really moving. And
yeah. I mean, I know we've dwelled quite a bit on Hoa's backstory and that kind of stuff. Any other stuff that you want to talk about the other parts, about Nasun, Essun, anything?
I don't think so. Nothing's immediately coming to mind.
Oh, yeah. One thing that I wrote down was that, you know, the book very much has themes of systematic racism, oppression. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing to me about that is that it doesn't really have any kind of overt racism that's displayed in terms of the way we would think about it, you know, just about skin color or ethnicity. It's more, there's marginalized people because of their capabilities. It seems so stupid to exclude people and oppress people based on just how they look or where they're from. So it's like the banality of just normal human evil and treating people badly because of how they look.
Yeah, if you can find a way to make a people group different and other, and then exploit them or oppress them, yeah.
I mean, that's explicitly in there, right? You're at this point, you're not quite human, and then you're not human at all.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some pretty explicit parallels to racism, such as, you know, even like the how they call them ragas instead of origines.
Yes,
you know, yeah. That's a pretty clear relation to something in the real world.
It is. Yeah. I was thinking about that and trying to figure out how to delicately refer to it. But yeah, like the slang mm-hmm. term to exclude someone.
And how it's used, you know, as, what's the word? It's used, you know, as a way to hurt people, you know, when the oppressor calls them raga, but then they can call each other that, in a friendly way.
Yeah. I get the, in Kastrima, especially with Yika and others, they're trying to take that word and make it their own, right?
Right,
and,
define pride.
We're going to take ownership of that word. We can use it in mm-hmm. that way, and it means something different.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that you see.
Yeah. I think another thing that when you look at everything that written that Jemison has written, this book pretty explicitly deals with, you know, racism and oppression and systems and stuff, but it's still very much, it's still metaphorical. It's still like a completely different world. And it's so fun to compare that to her latest series, The City We Became and The World We Make, which I think is about to come out. It's going to come out in November, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's just so much more explicitly about the, it's not making racism something else. It's not making, you know, marginalized groups, a pretend marginalized group in a pretend world. It's the real world, and we're explicitly talking about it. So it's just, I think, I just kind of wonder if, like, Jemison as a person was, you know, getting fed up with, like, I was trying to be subtle, I was trying to, like, say it, but people still aren't getting it. So I'm just going to, like, be explicit now and not hide it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can, when you mentioned one of her earlier book series that she couldn't sell because the protagonist was black, you know, or some of the main characters were black, and people wouldn't buy it. And I think there are folks, I think, who would have a hard time believing that that was the case. They would want to believe that, no, it's just all a meritocracy, and a good book gets published. And no, it's a business. And unfortunately, the realities of the way our world works sometimes is there's very cold calculations about, well, how can I sell this book? I can't expect people to want to read it if the main character doesn't look like them. And it's a terrible judgment on our society that that's the case.
Yeah. I mean, especially since the Dreamblood duology is brilliant. I love it. It's like, I don't know if I like Dreamblood or The Broken Earth better.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And that's just two books, right? You said
duology? Yeah, just two.
I may link in the show notes. There was a good kind of interview with her. I think it was right after she won the Hugo for The Stone Sky, and somewhere in New York, they had a library. And she's being kind of interviewed by P. Jelly Clark.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, terrific discussion. Am I right in thinking that I feel like the book is explicit in this, that Kalenly was kind of excluded from the final G.R. Kennedy project, and she was pregnant. We learned that. Mm-hmm. And am I correct in thinking that her descendants were Origenes?
That was my interpretation, that she was kind of like the mother of all Origenes.
Yeah. I thought that, I mean, I like the fact that the book basically shows you the entire origin of all of this, where you have the Origenes are all coming from Kalenly's line, and then the Stone Eaters are, you know, the ones who were the tuners at the time. And that the earth essentially meted out punishments proportionally to the responsibility of the people involved, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the earth recognized that, okay, the conductors are really the bad ones here, and they've manipulated and created the tuners to do this thing. They're not really responsible for it, so I'm going to be a little easier on them. As long as I'm around, they get to be around. But the guardians, like the description of the core stones burrowing through them, makes my skin crawl a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Even the thing that the tuners did, where they realized, okay, the earth is going to do this thing where it punches a bunch of obelisks down into the core to cause the shattering, that they were able to put in a 100-year delay. And to the earth, that didn't even seem like anything. And so that was like the idea of geologic time and, you know, time scales for even the Stone Eaters is a cool idea.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And I think Jemison kind of did a good job portraying the closeness of the Stone Eaters to the earth through the fact that they did everything so slowly. Just kind of show that they are operating on kind of a different dynamic.
Well, and then even the differences between steel, I can't remember steel's original name. I'm getting it mixed up with Renanus. Renoir. Was it Renoir?
I think it was Renoir.
Yeah. They all end with wa, right? Mm-hmm. But where he's just sort of bitter, and he was always kind of the angry one, whereas Hoa has realized the way to make this immortality palatable is to have a friend and to have a purpose. Yeah. And so I really, it's very sweet at the end when Hoa has patiently waited for Esun to become a Stone Eater and to emerge. And then he tells her the story and says, you know, what do you want to do? And she says, I want to make the world better. And it's just a wonderful ending.
Yeah, It was really beautiful. I really liked that the Stone Eaters were all so different and complicated too. I think it would have been really easy to create this concept of a Stone Eater and make them really monolithic and say all Stone Eaters are like this, but Jemison made them really distinct and have different factions even among themselves.
Yeah. I think I've come to the end of my notes.
Cool.
All right. Well, I guess we can kind of sum up with final thoughts on the book and the trilogy in general. So you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, this book is just amazing. It's enjoyable. You know, it has great world building, great characters, great writing. Just the plot is amazing. And, you know, it does all come together. And I mean, aside from just the craftsmanship and the enjoyment, it just, I think it says some really profound things about humanity and the way our societies work. And it does so beautifully and with nuance. So I think this completely deserves all of the Hugos that it got for every single book in the series. And I discovered N.K. Jemisin because of LeVar Burton Reads, the podcast. He read one of her stories and he introduced her as an author by saying, he was so effusive. It was amazing. He's like, she won back to back to back Hugos for every single book in her Broken Earth trilogy. And so then I like looked her up and read it. And I mean, they absolutely deserve it. They're amazing. And having reread them now, they hold up. They're just really, really great books.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I have some of her other work that I need to get to at some point when I have more reading time. I have her anthology of stories called How Long Till Black Future Month that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing. I think I could start sprinkling that in. The nice thing about an anthology is you can kind of read one at a time, but I'm so booked up. I've got a few more months and then I'll have a little more time.
Well, it's really good when you get to it.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Good. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know it's been a while since I invited you on. That's the way it works.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So before we sign off, where can people find you?
I'm primarily on YouTube. I have a BookTube channel called Kristinell SFF Reader. You can find me there. I also have a Twitter that I almost never actually tweet on. I also have an Instagram that I go through waves where sometimes I'm really into it and sometimes I'm not as much into it, but I do book reviews and stuff on Instagram. My name there is Kristinell SFF, I think. So you can find me at those places. I'm also on Goodreads if you want to friend me on Goodreads, and I do reviews for almost everything I read on Goodreads.
Awesome. All right, Kristen, thank you again so much for doing this. It's been fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Kristen, and I highly encourage you to check out her YouTube channel. I'll put a link in the show notes to that and all her other contact information. So as always, thank you so much for listening. If you want to support the show, retweet, share with your friends, leave a review if you'd like to. And if you would like to sign up for the Patreon, you can do that at patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast. I am down to, I think I've got 3 titles left that have not been claimed. So again, I'm just reiterating this. If you would like to claim one of those, go up to the website, fill out the contact form, or shoot me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or find me on Twitter as well, @hugospodcast. Okay, I think that'll do it for this time. Thank you so much again for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.